Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody, on a relatively melancholy Tuesday night. Seth Kame and Sean Palmer, a big show. And I was so looking forward to this week. My busy season after working 61 out of 62 days, and yes, that was what I had figured out. I am now finished. It's the beginning of baseball season, which is more exciting to Sean than to myself. Basketball playoffs, hockey playoffs. Yeah, we're starting with none of that. We start with, well, we're obviously going to touch on Boston. Sean has a greater impact on him than on myself, and we'll discuss that a little bit. But even before we start with that, I want to talk about, in my mind, the greatest play-by-play announcer of all time died this afternoon. Pat Summerall.
Wow, don't be too frank right there. He died.
Well,
welcome, everybody. Maybe he passed away. Maybe he, I mean, there are better ways of saying this, but Pat Summerall has passed away. Definitely one of the top three or four to me play-by-play guys. And I believe Seth and I were, by the way, thanks for joining us. Sean Palmer here. And Seth and I were talking about this right before the show started. I believe he's the first guy to make the transition from the playing field to the booth, leading the way for a litany of other players turned announcers. And if he leaves nothing else as his legacy, that is definitely one of them. I mean, we were thinking about maybe Don Meredith or Frank Gifford, but I believe that Summerall played in the 50s, so he probably did it before those guys. Definitely the most prolific guy to make that change.
Well, he played in the 50s. I'm not sure if he started his announcing career in the 50s. I think his announcing career may have started later. He was most famous, of course, for teaming with John Madden for CBS Sports, doing NFC games for the better part of 25 years. He did the U.S. Open tennis. He did the Masters golf. He was a legendary football player who became a more legendary announcer. And usually, that's not usually how it works. But he passed away after a lengthy illness at the age of 82, 83.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the people that remember Pat Summerall, at least, I would get a generation after us. Seth and I are both 36, so most of the listeners, and if you'd like to call in and talk about Pat Summerall or anything else, 760-283-0846. Most of the generation below us don't remember Pat Summerall in his prime. They remember Pat Summerall as making mistakes here and there. He did have a little bit of dementia as he grew older, as most people do. Pat Summerall and John Madden were the best. I mean, the best. And in fact, when Fox got the NFL, they said they wouldn't do it without getting Summerall and Madden as a combo. Not just Madden. I mean, they were a team. And I'm looking it up right now. When he last played in 1961. So that was before Don Meredith even finished his career. So I'm looking at, we have this great thing called the Internet. And it kind of tells, after retiring, Summerall was hired by CBS Sports in 1962. So I'm thinking that if Meredith was playing still, he definitely did it before Meredith. But, I mean, you look at the announcers today, most of those guys that go from the field to the booth are not the play-by-play guys. They're the color commentators like Bill Walton and John Barry and Mark Jackson. Even Frank Gifford was more of a color commentary guy, an expert, so to speak. Pat Summerall was the play-by-play guy. And there's no guy that was, I'll do a coin flip between him and Al Michaels any day.
Yeah. I found him significantly less arrogant than Al Michaels, which is why
there are many people in this world that are significantly more arrogant than Al Michaels. So
I didn't say the bar was that low in that one. I remember him from doing the U.S. Open tennis. I remember seeing the highlights of a lot of the great NFC games, NFC championships games, San Francisco, Dallas in 81. With Clark making the catch. He used to do, as a Giants fan, he used to do a lot of NFC East games, Giants, Cowboys, Eagles, Redskins, some combination of that. We felt we were really fortunate to get him and Madden in their prime for the better part of pretty much my youth from the 80s through college.
I'd agree with that. And also you get him, I mean, we grew up with John Madden football, the first version of that, and he was a play-by-play guy on that as well.
Actually, the Yankees are actually doing a memorial to him right now on MSG.
To Pat Summerall. Yeah. Well, Pat Summerall did play with the Giants and played at Yankee Stadium. So that makes perfect sense for them to be doing that. That's on the YES Network. If those would like to listen to us and watch that on mute, go right ahead. Once again, if you'd like to call in 760-283-0846 about this or anything else that we talk about today. And, yeah, I mean, Pat Summerall, legendary announcer. And like you said, I'm very happy that I lived in the New York market when he was – I'm a Jets fan. Everybody that listens to the show knows that. But it was an honor to listen to him and Madden at their prime. I haven't heard anybody better. I probably never will when it comes to football. I think Al Michaels is better in some things. Summerall was the jib. If you want to make a comparison, take away his playing career, he was the Jim Nance of his time. He did everything, and he did everything well. I think Jim Nance does an incredible job and does everything well, except for marriage. But that's another story.
Oh, really?
I know. I went there.
That was terrible. And he is remarried, so we don't. So he may. And look, he did marriage well for 20 some odd years.
Yeah,
so.
It was cold. I apologize. It was cold, and
I'm the one that makes those kind of stupid comments.
I know. Okay, so getting on to back onto the serious stuff. So Boston yesterday. So I'm a runner, or I used to be, and hope to be again. I lived in Boston for a couple of years. I didn't see it live. And I just got off the phone, ironically, with a member of my family where she is looking at all this coverage still. And my response to her is, why? What do you hope to gain more from this tragedy than you've already seen? And her response was, I want to see who's responsible. And again, my response is, why? And Seth, maybe you, I mean, I'm a little bit more emotionally attached to this than you are. Maybe, and this person in my family definitely did not live in Boston, so she probably is along the lines of you. Are you still watching coverage? Are you still interested in this? Is this something that you're looking at?
There's a few reasons. For those of you who don't know, I lived in Washington, D.C. for 9/11. I was walking out of my door when the plane hit the Pentagon. I'm from the New York vicinity, and so when 9/11 hit, I had people in the New York City not knowing where they were working, where they were living, so on and so forth. I lived in D.C. and got to watch, and the stories I could tell you from that were to this day still traumatizing. But Boston didn't even have close to the same impact for me for a variety of reasons. Number one, I never lived there. Number two, I have very few. I don't really know anybody there. I know one or two people, but no one I would consider close. Number three, when people made the comparison to 9/11, I don't really see it.
Boston don't make this comparison, Seth. I've talked to a bunch of my friends there today. Maybe people outside of New York or outside of Boston are making it. The people inside are not.
No.
They're not making that comparison at all.
As terrible as it is, and I'm not trying to minimize it in any capacity, you had what seemed to me almost like pipe bombs. You know, this doesn't strike me as an international terrorist act where you'd have a group like an Al-Qaeda, like a whoever, Hezbollah, saying that they're taking credit for this. This strikes me as some kind of extrapolation from Newtown, from kind of the more domestic terrorism act. And not that that makes it any better, because it certainly doesn't. And to answer your question, I actually had just come home from, ironically, finishing a busy season, put on the TV, opened up a beer, and was about to crash for an hour. And then I saw what happened, and my Facebook was lit up with all these things. And then obviously I watched it for about 2 or 3 hours and said that was enough.
Yeah.
And then I had the TV on the rest of the night, but I wasn't watching anything. I didn't. There's nothing to be done on my behalf. I would have happily donated blood. I probably will tomorrow. But there's nothing that can be done. There's nothing I really need to see. So I didn't really see any point. And to be honest,
yeah,
it was emotionally tiring to watch.
Well, I totally agree with that. I mean, Seth, you joke all the time about me not working at work. yesterday I didn't work. I will tell you flat out, and I told my boss that as he was leaving at 5:30. He's like, okay, I'm leaving. And I said, okay. He said, because I really can't get anything done anymore. And he wasn't talking about watching coverage. He just couldn't get anything done. I said, that's funny, because I haven't gotten anything done for the last 3.5 hours. Because I hadn't. I basically was sitting catatonic at my computer and just making sure that people were okay. I called friends I hadn't spoken to in 2 years, who I don't speak to on a regular basis, if at all. They're runners. I knew that they were running the marathon or had in the past to make sure that they were okay. And they were. And this is a street, Boylston Street, for those that do not go to Boston very often, which is the main drag, for lack of a better term. It would be the same thing as having a bomb on Madison Avenue or Broadway. That's what it is to Boston. And it made me remember back to those times. It definitely hit me a lot harder than it did most of the people in New York, I would think. But right now, my thoughts are not about who did this. Whoever did this is scum. And that's the end of that. And they'll get caught, because they always do. My thoughts are with the people that suffered tragedy. I've run a marathon before. I've run several marathons before. And what should be the best day, or one of the best days of a person's life, running that marathon, is forever tainted. And that's the sad part about this to me. I remember crossing those finish lines and going, wow, what a fantastic accomplishment. Even though my body was telling me, what the hell are you doing? And that accomplishment, I can only hope these people that were stuck in Kenmore, which is about a mile from where the explosions were, they'll take that experience and come back next year. And they'll come back the year after, and they'll run and run and run again, and not to be deterred. If you're going to take anything away from this, that's what you take away. Do not be deterred. Run again. Be there. I may actually go up there next year and watch the marathon, show some support. I mean, at this point, that's the thing I can do. So,
I was gonna say, I actually would be interested in doing that also, because it's after my busy season. So I may want to do that as well.
Well, I have car wheel drive. So if any of our listeners would like to take a trip up to Boston, there are now 2 more seats in the Schwalmobile for next year's marathon. So email, text, whatever, find it. And there are a lot of out of every tragedy comes a lot of heroes and heroism, and Joe Andreuzzi, he just finds a way. And if you don't know who I'm talking about, he's the offensive lineman for the Patriots, whose 3 brothers were in 9/11. And yesterday, in one of the more special images, you see Joe Andreuzzi picking up the runner and walking her to safety. And like I said, out of every tragedy comes a lot of heroes. And those doctors and that ran the course and then ran right into the smoke, you're all heroes. And I can only wish you the best to all those people that are in the hospital. Get well, because you'll run again. One way or another, you'll run again. So I really don't have much more to say on the Boston thing. I mean, it's completely tired me out more than anything else. So let's think of something on the bright side. Well, one more thing. Credit to the Yankees. And the Yankees and Red Sox have a whole lot of history, and it ain't good history. but today they're doing something that I didn't think was going to be done ever. And Seth, tell us about it.
Well, in honor of, as anyone who's been to a game at Fenway, they always celebrate the seventh, I think it's the seventh inning, with Sweet Caroline. And in honor of that, at Yankee Stadium today, after the third inning, they're going to play Sweet Caroline. It's kind of interesting. Well, I have the game on mute right now, and it's just, it's kind of obviously, and this is Jackie Robinson Day, so everyone is wearing number 42. And in honor, of course, of him breaking the color barrier in 1947, or 48, I guess, 65 years.
Yeah, you're right. It was 47.
It was 47, and I guess it's 66 years, not 65.
66 years.
And, of course, the movie came out this week. And, you know, and obviously New York and Boston have a healthy, healthy hatred for each other when it comes to the sports realm. I think it's a pretty...
good understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a small way to put it. But at the end of the day, you know, this obviously all these things supersede that. And
yeah, my brother, when I moved to Boston, I told him, and he knows I'm a Jets fan, I go, what am I going to do going to Boston with a Jets jersey? And he looked at me and he goes, you're really lucky. I go, how am I lucky? I got to walk into a Patriots bar with a Jets jersey. He goes, you're not a Yankees fan. Touche. But, yeah, healthy rivalry, and you know what? Some things supersede that. And I'm really glad to see that the Yankees stepping up and doing something. And most of the sports teams are doing something. So moving on to Jackie Robinson, which I believe Seth and I are going to go see this week. So we'll be happy to give you a review next week on the show of the the movie 42. The most influential player in sports history, perhaps?
I don't think so. One of the most important, obviously, but I'm not influential. I don't know. There were athletes who had broken the color barrier in boxing well before. You had Jack Johnson, who was a heavyweight champion, Joe Louis, who was the heavyweight, who was one of the most beloved athletes in the world. I don't remember. I think Chuck Cooper broke the basketball barrier a few years later. It was an inevitability. And I'm not trying to diminish his importance. I think his importance is not underestimated. His influence may be. If you can distinguish between the two.
I'm trying to, but I'm not coming up with a good rationale for it.
I mean, what he did was extraordinarily important.
Right.
The way he handled himself, the way he got through everything. As for his influence, I don't know. I don't know if what he did influenced people, per se, is the right word.
Well, he certainly
influenced
opinions. African Americans to play.
But they were playing already.
Yeah.
You know, Larry Doby broke the American League barrier a year later. You had, it wasn't like, when I think of influential, I think more of a Muhammad Ali.
So were the influential people Branch Rickey and Bill Veeck?
Well, Bill Veeck
wasn't.
Because
they're the ones that really took it on the chin. I mean,
Bill Veeck wasn't the owner of the Dodgers.
No, he was the owner of the Indians.
Oh, you're talking about, okay, with Larry Doby.
Right. Well, Branch Rickey was the GM of the Dodgers.
GM.
Walter O'Malley was the owner, and Bill Veeck was the, I believe, the GM, if not the owner, of the Cleveland Indians that took on Larry Doby the next year. So,
were those
the influential people?
I think influential. I don't know. I don't. I see it as an extraordinarily important. I don't see it as influential.
Okay.
I think the more influential was once Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier and Larry Doby broke the color barrier. It was influential, I guess, in regards to that it started the influx of African Americans coming in and being, you know, they were the right, you know, Larry Doby, I don't know if Larry Doby was a Hall of Famer. Larry Doby had a pretty good career. Jackie Robinson is a borderline all-time great player. You know, to quote you, he would have made my Hall of Fame.
But when you made your Hall of Fame because of his play, because I look at his stats, and I'll pull them up in a second. He wasn't, if you look at his stats, an all-time great.
Right, but he was also the best second. I understand that, but he was the best second baseman of his era.
Okay.
And
I can go with that.
You know, stats, you know, look, obviously he would have gotten in if he hit 112. So that, you know, because of the importance of what he did. But
I mean, he only played played 9 seasons. He had 1,500 hits. So over 9 seasons, that's what, a buck 75?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said. I apologize. What did you say?
He had 1,500 hits over 9 seasons. So what's that, a buck 65 in the hits?
About that,
a year? Okay, he had 137 home runs. Now, granted, he was a second baseman. 734 steals, so over 9 years, that's about 80 runs batted in a year. So he had about 10 homers, 80 runs batted in. He had, you think of him as an all-time great stolen base guy, but he only averaged about 19 steals a year, and he batted .311. So, I mean, statistically, he wasn't any better or any worse than anybody else. And he only won one World Series, because that's all the Dodgers ever won. 6-time All-Star, Rookie of the Year, because nobody else was going to win it that year anyway. And he won one MVP. Now, he was named to the Major League Baseball All-Century team, which I'm not exactly sure. A lot of that was fan balloting as well. But does he make your Hall of Fame based on what he did on the field, or does he make your Hall of Fame based on the importance / influence of him on the baseball world?
It's obviously a combination of both.
Okay.
He was probably, I'm trying to think back to the great second baseman of that era, and there aren't too many that I can think of. Maybe Nellie Fox in Chicago.
Lou Beaudreau.
He was in the beginning. Right, but he was best in the late 40s, right when Robinson came in. He was the player manager for the Indians in 47, 48, around that time.
So you're
time.
Looking at the 1950s? I'm going to look this up but I understand what you're saying.
And he petrified opposing pitchers. Due to his running ability, and maybe he didn't steal very much, but I think that was also because that was not a Walter Alston kind of play. You know, they didn't. You know, they had Duke Snyder, they had Carl Furillo. They weren't exactly the running team of a great running team. And when I think of great second basemen of that era, Jackie Robinson, for better or for worse, is the name that comes to mind.
Yeah,
and not for
Bobby
worse.
Dore. I mean, there's Bobby Dore, there's Eddie Stanky. I agree with you. He's probably, for that 10-year period, the best second baseman in baseball.
Yeah.
And I understand that's how you define your Hall of Fame, because you compare it against the people of your time, correct?
Yes.
Now, my Hall of Fame is you're taking a 10-year period. And I'm not sure that defines your era so much. Kind of the Jack Morris argument that I have, in that for 10 years, you can pick any 10-year period, and is that your era? But I understand what you're getting at. It probably was the best in that 10-year period. So I think that you think of the hatred. I always love this story, and I'm sure it'll be brought out. Actually, I don't think it's brought out in the movie, because the movie only covers 2 years, the year that he was integrated and then the year after that. Or the year before and the year that he was. But Jackie Robinson retired. Do you know why he retired?
Yeah, he got
beyond
traded
the
to
fact
the Giants.
That he was getting old.
Yeah, he got traded to the Giants.
Giants,
so
he goes,
play for
I don't want to play. I played against him too much. I have no desire to be a Giant. I'm done. I don't know of any Yankee that would ever do that these days if you got traded to the Red Sox or likewise. In fact, most of the time they just willingly go, like Johnny Damon. That was a hatred. That was an absolute hatred. So, I mean, we'll definitely give you a little synopsis of that next week. When we'll review the film for you. We'll give it a thumbs up or thumbs down in the memory of Roger Ebert, who died in the last week as well. So, while we're on baseball, what is it with, and I know you haven't been following a whole lot, because you're finally come back from the dead, or the tax dead, if nothing else. And I think I informed you of this, and you didn't even know. What is it with the Mets playing in snowy fields, such as Minnesota and Colorado? Don't the schedule makers learn?
Yeah, that's kind of silly. You would figure, well, especially Minnesota is no longer in a dome, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So you would figure that Minnesota and Colorado would start most seasons, and Detroit as well, would start most seasons on the road as much as possible. My understanding is the Mets haven't played since about 1983.
Well, if you ask their fans, they haven't played since 1990, but that's probably true. They played, I think, one game in the last week because they got snowed out in Minnesota. And then they got snowed out the last two games in Colorado. Today they had a doubleheader, which has been delayed because of snow. And there are pictures all over the web, which is quite funny, of the president of the Rockies out there shoveling snow off the field.
At least he's earning
really
his money.
I'd love to see Hal Steinbrenner picking up a shovel.
Please.
Not going to happen.
And not anytime in the near future.
No, absolutely. But you would think that the powers that be would kind of schedule it better. But I guess every year we're going to have some snow outs because the season is just too long. They were playing in 35-degree weather the other day in Minnesota. It's a little ridiculous. So much for the springtime game. But we haven't talked with you all. Now, I'll say our number is 760-283-0846 if you'd like to chime in on any of this. Zach Greinke, were you alive for that?
I was alive for that. The Zach Greinke, Carlos Quentin rally in the alley? Brawl to the wall?
It was definitely something. The brawl on the mound.
It was kind of dumb.
What do you think?
I thought it was kind of dumb, and that's not exactly a professional opinion. But I cannot imagine that Zach Greinke was going to hit Carlos Quentin in a 1-1 game in the sixth or a 2-1 game in the sixth. On a 3-2 pitch. It makes absolutely no sense to me. So the only thing I can think of is that, I mean, also, I really don't have much of an opinion on it. I think it's ridiculous. You know, Quentin has led the league in getting hits by pitch several times over the years. So he's well known for crowding the plate. So this is not exactly a shock that he got hit. It is a shock that he decided to go after a guy 60 pounds lighter than he is.
Well, do you really let me ask you this, and you were not a big baseball player when you were a kid, correct? I mean, you played, but you didn't.
I retired after the third grade with a grand total of 4 hits.
And softball does not count. So,
yeah. Oh, I'm not a bad softball player. I was a good fielder. I couldn't
right.
hit, but I'm not a bad softball player.
Okay, so you're an all-field, no-stick middle infielder. Excellent. That's 6'2". Fantastic. Because that's where we need tall guys, in the middle of the field. Anyway, that being said, we will not be having the Seth and Sean softball team. But if you'd like to enlist Seth Kamens to be your second baseman, he does know how to bunt. He knows how to bunt in softball. He's got the legs. He'll be able to get on first. Anyway, that being said.
I'm not really sure how to respond to that. So.
Anyway. Look, Zach Greinke has hit Carlos Quentin numerous times in the past. And I understand it's harder to place a ball than most people think. I mean, these guys are professionals, but you're still throwing a 90-mile-per-hour fastball or whatever it is. And it's rather difficult. But if I'm the hitter Now, I'm not really sure, Seth, if you've gotten hit by a 90-mile-per-hour baseball before.
No, I have never been hit by a 90-mile. I've been hit by a 98-mile-an-hour tennis ball, but I'm not quite sure it's the same thing.
I got to think the tennis ball is a little bit more give.
Yeah, I would think so.
A little bit. So it hurts. I've gotten hit by a 90-mile-per-hour knuckleball in the butt. I have to say, I asked Cooperstown for my money back.
How exactly does one get hit by – what exactly is a 90-mile-an-hour knuckleball?
I got to tell you.
That doesn't even make sense.
I was in Cooperstown, and if you've ever been to Cooperstown, you know that there are batting cages all over the place. And I would hope that those listeners of ours that haven't been to Cooperstown go. It is by far the best Hall of Fame out there. Because the Football Hall of Fame looks like a motel. The Hockey Hall of Fame is in the basement. And the Basketball Hall of Fame, as Seth and I both went to, is in the middle of nowhere. Not the Cooperstown.
It looks like a golf ball.
Anywhere.
It's a combination of a golf ball and Epcot Center.
Okay. So the Hall of Fame, have you been to Cooperstown? I assume that your dad took you.
1983.
Okay. We may need another road trip. But anyway,
Rock on.
Cooperstown is lovely during the summer. Not during the winter. I've been there during both. Definitely stay away from the winter. During the summer, there were batting cages all over the place. So I went into one of these batting cages, and I saw that they have different types of pitches. So they have curveballs, they have sliders, they have knuckleballs, they have fastballs. And for those that don't know, a knuckleball is a very hard pitch to throw. It's even a harder pitch to know where the hell it's going. But you don't see it. Like, if you're just an amateur player like myself, I guarantee you haven't gotten in the cage or got it up the plate against a knuckleball ever. So I was like, oh, knuckleball, sure. I'll try that. And then I looked at it, I was like, 90 miles per hour? Nobody throws a 90-mile-per-hour knuckleball. Knuckleballs come in at like 60. I think R.A. Dickey throws the hardest one at like 75. I was like, this could be cool.
I think he's the only person who throws one at this point.
Right. So I was like, this could be cool. It's going against a 90-mile-per-hour knuckleball. Now, a knuckleball, like the name, basically a person will grip it on his knuckles, and there is no spin on the ball. It basically just comes out like you would shot put a ball, and it moves. It dances because it's got no rotation. So imagine something like that coming at you at 90 miles per hour, not exactly going straight, and all of a sudden looking like it's going to hit you. Well, I turned and got hit square in the butt by a 90-mile-per-hour knuckleball. So I went straight to the... I know, but when I'm 17, that hurt a little bit more. And like you said, it doesn't really have much of a give. So I went straight back to Cooperstown and got myself my money back, my $1.25.
So
I don't know where I was going with this. Where was I going?
I stopped trying to figure that out about 5 minutes ago.
Really? Where's that?
Oh, we haven't had a really
Zach
for a while.
Zach Greinke. So the concept is, when you get hit by a 90-mile-per-hour pitch, I don't care who you are, it hurts.
True.
He had been hit by Greinke 3 times in, I think it's 6 years. At some point, you just have to say enough is enough, whether you think he's throwing at you or not.
So you don't blame him for charging the mound?
I blame Greinke for ducking the shoulder. The hell are you doing? You're a $147 million pitcher. What the hell are you ducking your shoulder for against a guy that's 250 pounds heavier? So he got an 8-game suspension. Warranted? Not warranted? Too light? Too much? What do you think?
Certainly not too little. Greinke is now out for, 3 months? 2 months?
No. 2 months. 2 months.
So, I mean, I think it's reasonable. I would have probably gone for 10. So you could have two. So he would miss two of Greinke's starts. The comparison, but I'm okay with it. I don't think you can take him out for as long as Greinke's out, which is of course what Mike Socha had said, or one of the Angels had said. You're not going to deduct it for less because. He kind of went insane. So I don't have much of an issue with it.
Okay. Well, as I'm looking at the TV right now and the Yankees are tied 0-0 in the first inning with men on first and second for the Yanks. I'm a little disturbed by the fact that there's always interleague play. Like, this is what used to be a weekend, maybe once, twice a year, where there was all the interleague play done, and now because there are 15 teams in each league, it's every day. You think it takes a little bit away from it? Do you think it's an advantageous thing? Do you think they're going to expand? The DH will be more? What are your thoughts?
I think I'm not a fan of interplay.
And some size.
And some what?
Some size. You went.
No. Well, because I'm not a huge fan of interleague play to begin with. We talked about this a week or two ago. I think it had a purpose. I think it was to kind of create new rivalries. To create rivalries, which we had never seen, but always kind of hoped, you know, that would come into play. But I'm sorry, it's very hard to be excited about Yankees Arizona in the middle of April. I mean, I don't really have much of an opinion on it. I there's a lot of things. I'm not a fan of the DH. You know, you brought that up with Houston. I think inevitably it's going to probably. It's going to be a consistent fight whether it's going to stay in existence or not. I don't know. I think certain sports are better. I sound like a reactionary, but I think certain sports were just better in the past. And the baseball, it is reaction. I think it's called the reactionary as well. It's revisionary history, but I think you're a reactionary when you see things, and as opposed to a radical who wants things to change. Reactionary wants things to change back. You know, I was a bigger fan of baseball. You know, I'm a bigger fan of baseball without the DH. I was a bigger fan without interleague play. I didn't need expansion. Unlike football or basketball, unlike football where there are no other significant leagues elsewhere, there are significant baseball leagues in the Orient, in, you know, 30 other countries. I would have been perfectly happy keeping baseball at 24 to 26 teams, not at the 30 it is today. But,
so I'd like to give my co-host a little bit of credit. A reactionary is a person who holds political viewpoints that favor a return to the previous state. The status quo ante. Well done on our LSAT word of the day.
Look at me getting credit 2 weeks in a row.
I know, but
that.
You also gave credit to the Knicks. So moving on to the NBA where the playoffs start this weekend.
What a great segue that was. Jeez.
Thank you. Are you a reactionary? Would you like to go back to your quote at the beginning of the year and change it to? There have certainly been some surprises, and the Black Mamba may not return for a year. It's kind of hard watching the Lakers play without Kobe Bryant.
It's not easy, but they will. They're actually only a game. They're only two games out of the sixth spot. As strange as that sounds, I think they have two games left. Maybe they only have they only have one game left. So they're not going to be able to catch Golden State for six. They can catch Houston for seven because they actually play Houston tomorrow night.
Yeah.
And they're still a game up on Utah. But I think they need to. I think Utah has to win and Lakers have to lose, and Utah would win the tiebreak. It's a shame.
So you and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago when Kobe scored a magical point and I think jumped into fifth all time. And I don't think we talked about it on the show, but I'd like your opinions anyway, especially with him tearing his Achilles, and he may never play again. I mean, you don't know. I would say he probably will, but you don't know. Is Kobe Bryant an underrated player for his career? Because I'm kind of thinking he is. I didn't think he was that far up the charts. He's got what? Six rings? Five rings?
He has...
He's got three with Shaq and one other?
Two others. I believe he has five.
Two others. So he's got five rings.
He probably, when it's all said and done, and it is kind of hard to believe, he's probably the second greatest shooting guard of all time. The problem he's had is there's always been a very negative negative image around Kobe, from him being a cocky little you know what, coming out of high school to
the
college.
Arrogant twit. How about an arrogant twit? I think that's a good word. Yeah.
To the rape trial in Denver. To the will they stay together? Will they not? With his high school, with his wife / I think it was high school sweetheart or the girl he met his first year in L.A. He always had that arrogance about him where, and he just, to be honest, he wasn't Michael. And that was always the biggest problem. You know, he followed the greatest player of all time. And, for all intents and purposes, no one really contradicts that Jordan is the greatest player of all time. And he wanted to be Jordan. He was never going to live up to that legacy. Now, he's also had incredible bouts of selfishness. Where you can talk about how he refused to shoot in a game 7 against the Suns many years ago. He's had trouble with working with Shaquille and Phil Jackson. And when it's all said and done, I think he comes back. I think his ego is too big to let him retire in this note. I think he goes down as when he retires, he will be probably considered the second greatest shooting guard of all time. Just above Jerry West, behind Jordan.
I definitely go with you. I mean, he's on the Bill Simmons pyramid in the Hall of Fame, no question.
Yeah.
And the fact, is he in the Seth Kamen's Hall of Fame as well? Because Bill Simmons.
Yeah. That's not even a question.
Just make it sure. So he's in the Seth Kamen's Hall of Fame as well, so we can all rest easy now. And the fact is, but is he an underrated player? I mean.
Yes.
I think he may be a better defensive player than Jordan ever was. I really do. I mean,
wow.
Only in the last couple of years has he had a lockdown defender with him. While Jordan had a lockdown defender with him the entire time, if not more than one. So he was able to play maybe not the best player defensively. And sometimes he didn't. I mean, Byron Russell was not the best player on that team. But he certainly matched up with Byron Russell for all of the Utah games.
Well, to be fair, who else was he going to match up with? He wasn't going to guard Stockton, and he wasn't going to guard Karl Malone. So there really wasn't.
Hornacek.
It would have made no difference. Hornacek was a spot-up shooter. He wasn't going to, whether Pippen guarded him or...
I agree with that concept. I agree with your
look. The biggest problem I have with Jordan is Jordan, in retrospect, is a vastly overrated college basketball player. Jordan was a great college basketball player, but was not one of the all-time greats. As a pro, Jordan was the greatest I've ever seen. He was a great defensive player. He was an extraordinary scorer. As he got older, he became a great leader. He took no crap. He gave no crap. And, he is well warranted to be the greatest basketball player of all time and probably the greatest athlete of our lifetime.
So wait a second. So let's put Kobe in the 80s and in the early 90s, okay? Internet is not what it is today. Half the crap that he probably went through with Shaq doesn't appear on the front page. It doesn't appear in the blogosphere. It doesn't appear on ESPN.com. It's all just shuttled under the bridge. The same way that Jordan having arguments in practice, because we know they happened. I mean, for those that didn't read Jordan Rules with Stan Smith, we know these things happened. But they only came out in books. They didn't appear in real time. Yeah, Kobe was an arrogant twit. But then you cannot convince me that Jordan wasn't the same.
Yeah, he was.
So, but it wasn't reported as much.
Don't tell
me that Michael Jordan didn't cheat on his wife, because that happened. He acknowledged that happened. But it didn't get the play that Kobe did. I guess you put them in different contexts. And do you have the same bad opinion of Kobe if you put him in the 80s or in the 90s? It's the 90s, sorry, the late 80s, early 90s. I think most of Jordan, why people look up to Jordan and don't look up to Kobe, is because of the attitude that people have towards the two players rather than their accomplishments on the court. And the silence is deafening. And it's still deafening. Did I lose Seth?
You did. We'll be back moment. I am now back. I got disconnected at the beginning of your diatribe, and I just got reconnected at the end of it.
Basically, what I'm saying is, if Kobe existed in the 80s, and none of that arrogant twit comes out, because Jordan was certainly an arrogant twit, we just learned about it later, that Kobe would be on the same pedestal as Jordan. I think people just don't like Kobe.
I don't know. I think it's an interesting argument. I don't know if Kobe – I don't think so. I, as great as Kobe is, he's not Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan simply is the greatest basketball player of all time. And he may be a half step behind, a half level behind – but I don't see them in the same level.
Okay.
As great as Kobe is, and you know, when you put together the all-time greatest team of the top 12 of all time, most likely Kobe's on it, and I think that's as big a compliment as you can give anybody.
Agreed. Okay, so we're coming up. We got the NBA playoffs starting this week. Have your predictions changed at all? Because I believe you had, I believe we both had the Heat over. No, I had Oklahoma City over the Heat, and I believe you had the Heat over Oklahoma City. And I believe
I forget
for the James Harden deal.
I think I had Boston over. I think I had Boston over LA.
Oh, you did. You're right. You did have Boston over.
So
LA.
Yes, my thoughts have changed a little bit, to say the least.
Okay, so where are you? I mean, what? Are you convinced that, obviously, I think you're convinced that both those teams are probably not going to make the finals?
No. I am pretty comfortable with the fact that neither of these teams will make the finals. Boston died the second Rondo got hurt, and they had looked old before that, to be honest. I thought they had 1 year left in them. It didn't look like they do, although I think them playing the Knicks is going to be one massive battle.
I think it's going to be a great series.
Yes.
I think it's going to be a phenomenal series that will be must-watch TV. I really do. I think it'll harken back to the Miami Heat Knicks series with Jeff Van Gundy on Alonzo Mourning's leg.
Well,
I think it'll be that dirty.
I hope it's more watchable than those series, because the only people that enjoyed watching that basketball were Knicks fans and Heat fans.
Was this guy?
Yeah. Well, that would be why you were a Knicks fan, but they were
true.
Not. It was not artistic basketball. It was not in.
I agree. It was dirty, dirty basketball. So let's say, so going on to the series, I mean, you got, and we can talk a little bit more about this next week, and we will. But let's take the first round series at least, because
okay.
It may be over by the time we get to next week's show, and we'll talk a little bit more. Like I said, a little bit more about this next week. So we got the. The Knicks are going to go up against the Celtics. So what do you think about that?
I like the Knicks in seven. I think it
seven.
Was seven.
Wow, okay.
I still love the heart of Boston. I, as good as the Knicks have been, I'm still not sold on them as a playoff team.
Wow, really? You're not sold on the Knicks as a playoff team?
First of all,
I don't think these first round series are seven games.
Yes, it is.
They are. Okay. My bad.
Yeah,
but okay.
Now, I think it'll go seven. I think the Knicks will win game seven in MSG. I think Boston has too much pride to go out in a four or five game series, and I just think they'll win a game six at home.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna take the Knicks in five. I don't think Boston has enough. I think that they're going to really, really struggle to score. So I'm going to take the Knicks in five. How about your Milwaukee Bucks versus the Miami Heat?
I will take Miami in. I'll take Miami in five. I'm going to give Milwaukee a game.
I'm not going to give Milwaukee any credit whatsoever. I'm taking them in four. I'm taking Miami in four. I just don't think there's anything stopping the Heat in the first round. The Pacers, now, this could always change because the Hawks and Bulls are tied with the Hawks having a game in hand, and they play tonight. So we got the Pacers. Let's say it stays status quo. The Pacers against the Bulls. No Derrick Rose. He's out for the rest of the year.
I like Indiana in six. Without Derrick Rose, I think Indiana is too tough for them. As much credit as I want to give Chicago, I don't think they win that.
Okay, I will take Indiana in seven. I think they have to go back to Conseco Fieldhouse. And in one of the better matchups, as it should be, the 4-5, the Nets taking on the Hawks.
I actually think Brooklyn wins this relatively easily. Not because I have a great deal of faith in Brooklyn, although I don't have a great deal of faith in Atlanta. I think they've overachieved this year. I think you have a superstar who we don't know where he's going. I think his thoughts are in different directions. And Atlanta has just never been a very good playoff team. And
wow, the fact that you just said that Josh Smith is a superstar.
Well, he considers himself a superstar.
Yes, but nobody else does.
That is true.
And I think that's part of the problem.
That is true.
So I'm gonna take the Nets in five. I don't think it goes back to Atlanta. I'm like you. I think Reggie Evans will be able to hold his own on the boards with Al Horford and Josh Smith. And I think Josh Smith is going to use this to try and propel his free agency. I think he's got his mind on that rather than playing. So I think that the Nets in five. So going over to the West, the Thunder against, let's assume that the Lakers make it. The Thunder versus the Lakers in the first round.
How great would this have been with Kobe? Jeez. I like Oklahoma City in five. Without Kobe, I don't see it being that competitive.
I'll tell you one thing though. I think that this team, the way it's constructed right now for the Lakers, first of all, it's going to be the team that you see next year because I think Howard resigns. You're going to see a much different type team. I think you're going to see a lot more pick and roll with Nash. I think that they're going to surprise people. I think they go six. I think they take them even on the home court of the Lakers, but I think it goes six. I think Howard has a monster game in every game. I think this is his coming out party, if there's such a thing in the Lakers. The Spurs and the Rockets, which I think is one of the more interesting series of all.
I think all of these series in the West, except for one and eight, are looking great. I very, very hesitantly will take San Antonio in seven. But I think Houston will give them a battle. Harden has become a superstar. That team is fast and young and enthusiastic. And in about, if they do get Howard, you got to watch out for them in 2014. But I think they are a year away from really making a play. So I'm going to go with Houston. I'm going with
seven?
San Antonio. I'm sorry. I'm San Antonio in seven.
Okay. If this was flipped and Houston played at home, I would take Houston. I really think that Houston is going to give them everything. And I think that this is the biggest potential upset of any of the matchups in either conference. San Antonio is not only old, but they are hurting. Tony Parker is hurting. Manu is hurting. Duncan is a shell of himself. You know, it's funny. I really want to pick Houston. I'm going to go with San Antonio in seven the same way you did. The Warriors against the Nuggets in what may be the most exciting matchup, just in the lack of defense that's going to be shown in this series. I wouldn't be surprised if every game was 125 to 120.
I sincerely hope so. I think that would be a blast. I was kind of hoping for a Denver-Houston series, to be honest, but it is looking like Denver, and all credit to Golden State. Stephon Curry is a stud.
Yep.
And with Denver hurting, Lawson hurt, Gallinari out for the year, I'm going Denver in six. Golden State has not been on a great run the last month or so, other than Curry. I do think Denver will hold on, but it is going to be one monster of a – it's going to be one fun series to watch.
So I always have to pick one upset, and this is where it is. I think the playoffs are where superstars come to shine. I don't think Denver has one. Like you said, Lawson's been injured. Gallinari's gone for the year. Who knows where JaVale McGee's head is at? Every game, who knows where his head is at? It may be on the other side of the court. This is where Stephen Curry puts up 40 a game, 35-40 a game, and this is the end. And it may be one and done for them, one series and out, but it's going to be a fun one series and out. I think Andrew Bogut comes to play. This is where you get the upset. I see it in six games on Golden State's home court in front of what may be the best fans in the NBA. And our last but not least, which will be one of those Knicks-Heat series, the Grizzlies are at the Thunder. Well, actually, we don't really know that yet. We know that this is probably going to be the matchup, but the Clippers have one game in hand, and if they tie, I believe the Grizzlies get it. So it's still the same matchup, but who knows where they're going to be. So Grizzlies and Clippers, and I'm going to take the Grizzlies in seven.
Don't they seem like they play every year?
Yeah. And it's always a great matchup, isn't it?
It is. It is. I'm actually going to take the Grizzlies as well in seven. I think the realistic for whoever has the home field, home court, I think will win. So because also, well, it's such a difficult game to call. I'm going to go with Memphis simply because I just think they're a better team. Although the Clippers have the best player in Chris Paul.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of how they do in this playoff series will determine whether Chris Paul stays or goes. I think if they lose this first series, Chris Paul really has to look around and say, is this the team that I want to be in or be on? Okay, so we've got about 4 minutes left. Would you like to end first?
I will. Doug Collins is going to be resigning as the coach of Philly. And Doug I really hope to see him back on the side. He's the best basketball analyst I can remember, the color man I can remember. But he always just seems to have just had an assortment of bad luck when it has come to the NBA. His Olympic team in 72 gets robbed. You know, he gets hurt and his NBA career doesn't go the way he wants. He coaches the Bulls right before Phil Jackson in the championships. He goes to D.C. to coach with Jordan. It doesn't really work. He builds this Philly team out of nothing, and they just this year everything falls apart with the Bynum deal. Bynum not playing a single moment with them. I just hope he gets – he's such a great coach, great basketball mind, seems like a real class act. I hope he just gets some peace. And, you know, I really wish him the best of luck going forward.
Well, here I'm hoping Doug Collins winds up on the bench for the next Olympic team because I think that's the place where he needs to be.
I think that'd be great. I think I said that a couple weeks ago. I think that'd be a great call.
I think I was going to talk about Doug Collins as well. The problem that Doug Collins has is he's no good for this NBA the way it is. He's got to get a veteran team, and he just never gets one. He always gets the really – I think he could bring a team to a championship. The problem is he's kind of like the Bobby Valentine.
The Buck Showalter?
NBA. For the Buck Showalter, yeah. The Buck Showalter or the Bobby Valentine of the NBA, in which he gets these really, really young teams and he whips them into shape, but then they get tired of hearing him and they tune him out. And he had the worst luck this year in that Andrew Bynum was hurt the entire year because I really think that team could have done something with him. Well, we'll talk next week about the NHL playoffs. Hopefully the Islanders will be in it. We'll have a little bit more to talk about there. Yep. And the second round of the NBA playoffs. I know. What's that, NHL? I understand, Seth. And I'll brief Seth on the NHL between now and then. And we'll have our review of 42.
Also, most importantly, we're going to have our NFL draft picks.
Yes, we will. So it'll probably be a two-hour show next week.
Hey, yo. So, two-hour show.
So catch us next week for Seth Kamens. This has been Sean Palmer, Seth and Sean on BackSportsPage.com. See y'all.
Peace out.